Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same? Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. You say, one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share it, leaves you, baby.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. This is James Martinez with another edition of Cash Flow, a very, very, very special edition of Cash Flow, actually. So we are back, as we would say before, talking about cold fusion. As you know, I've been talking about this for quite some time, and it's been my effort here, including with all the listeners here, to kind of make the public awareness, raise the level of public awareness on cold fusion, get some public support for it, find out a little bit more about it. My special guest today is Dr. Peter Hagelstein. We're going to bring him on in just a moment. Just a quick announcement prior to bring him on is just to let you know, next on the 20th, we're going to be having comedian and actor Rick Overton come in and talk about the effects of the economy in show business. And then, as scheduled as always, on the 21st, we'll have Ion. And then on the 22nd, we'll be having David Cobb, again, former presidential candidate of the Green Party, here on the 22nd. So, but now, brace yourselves, everybody, because for those of you that are underachievers out here, wait till you listen to this gentleman's resume. It's nothing short of spectacular. I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, my God, this is really amazing. But here's today. It's these type of guys that are going to be that have worked on cold fusion and know quite a bit about it. For those of you that are new listeners, that are listening from all over the place, because we have like 15, 20 countries listening here. So you can go to coldfusionnow.org. and find out exactly what we're referring to as far as cold fusion, what that means. There's a piece from 60 Minutes that occurred there. But let's go ahead, and I could spend 15, 20 minutes just going into this gentleman's resume here, but I won't take that long. But you do need to hear this. Dr. Peter Hagelstein currently, it seems to me, because I'm looking at his website as well, is Associate Professor of Electrical Engineering at MIT, at the Research Laboratory of Electronics there. His undergraduate and graduate work at MIT was considered to be applied physics at most universities. He was a freshman at MIT in 1972, graduated MIT in 1974. In 1975 to 1979, he had the Hertz Fellowship. In 1976, he got his bachelor's and master's degree awarded. From 1976 to 81, he was an MIT graduate student working at Lawrence Livermore Lab on his PhD thesis. In 81, at MIT, he was got his PhD there. Now, I could go on and on and on. For those of you that really want to compare your life to what you have done to this gentleman, it's quite incredible. But currently, to present, he's working at academics at MIT, developed applied quantum physics course, developed numerological modeling course. It goes on and on and on here. I originally got his contact details from Dr. Edmund Storm, who I've interviewed here before, and he said, go ahead and contact this gentleman and have him speak a little bit about cold fusion. So without further ado, because I don't want to take up the entire time talking about your resume, because everybody can find it out, and trust me, everybody, he knows what he's talking about. Dr. Peter Hagelstein, thanks very much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Hi. Yes,
I can hear you. And congratulations, by the way, on your marriage. Just want to say that before we get started.
Thank you. Let's see, you're fading in and out on my end here. I don't know if that's supposed to be happening or if I've got a bad connection.
You may have a bad connection. It might improve, but if we'll try and train, see if we, Bill can, our producer can, change that up at the break. But I can hear you fine. It'll probably transcribe fine and it'll probably come through okay. But, We'll go from there, though. If we need to reconnect, we'll do that. But let's go ahead and I want to ask you, like, first and foremost, did you get into science at a really, really early age? Were you had an interest from the very beginning? Is that how it started for you, really?
Oh, high school, I think, is where I took an interest in it. Started with mathematics and went on to physics and later engineering and applied physics.
Mm-hmm. Now, during this time, because I know we've spoken a lot with many scientists here, where were you on the day Pons and Fleischmann went public about their cold fusion experiment?
I was on an airplane traveling out to California for a consulting job.
And what were your impressions when you first heard about that?
Well, I heard that it was going to happen a couple of days before. One of my colleagues at MIT, Louis Smolin, had come in and told me that there was going to be an announcement. And, I was very skeptical. The day after the announcement, I got briefed as to what was said. And, again, I was pretty skeptical.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why were you skeptical?
On the one hand, I was skeptical because the claim seemed to be unreasonable. And in addition, in an area where I'd worked previously, an amazing claim had come out of the same school, and it hadn't panned out. Mm-hmm. I had been working previously in X-ray laser research, and University of Utah had claimed to have made an X-ray laser on a tabletop, which was not a credible claim and turned out not to be correct.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So first impressions was this can't be possible and something's wrong and so forth.
Yeah. The group that I was consulting with at Livermore had been in contact with Martin Fleischmann for 5 or 6 weeks before the announcement. And they had a lot more details than was available publicly at the time. And they encouraged me to take it seriously.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that was, because a lot of people, you know, I've talked to other scientists here and other people, I've received emails from all over the world regarding this. Do you think it was a bad idea for them to announce that at that time, their claims?
I don't believe that it would have made a heck of a lot of difference with respect to what happened afterwards, subsequently. Mm-hmm. There's a theory that says that had they presented things differently, that there wouldn't have been such a controversy and so forth and so forth. And I don't think there was any way to have avoided the controversy. The claim itself is too big of a claim. It would have caught the attention of the media. It would have been on the radar screen. And it would have had to have been kicked off the radar screen, sort of independent of how it was handled initially.
You know, because a lot of people seem to think, you know, after that there was movies made, those guys were discredited. There's a lot of fluff having to do with, you know, terms of credibility and even tackling that issue. Did you ever think that in your future at that point when you first heard it that you'd be actually spending time researching cold fusion? And have you witnessed it before you in your labs or any other labs?
Let's see, did I think I was going to be working on cold fusion? The group that I was consulting with explained to me that if I wanted to get paid for my consulting work, I had to make progress on figuring out how it was working.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It sort of immediately became part of my consulting research. In terms of whether I've seen cold fusion effects in my own lab with my own eyes, the answers he asked.
And when you did, what was your intuitive reaction to it? Like, wow, this defies a lot that I ever thought was possible, and I just did it in front of me. I mean, what was your initial reaction?
Well, I didn't participate in cold fusion experiments immediately after the announcement. I was working on theoretical issues, trying to figure out if there was any way that it could work at all. Subsequently, I went to conferences and visited people's labs, and I saw presentations on people's experimental results. it took something in the neighborhood of 4.5 years.
Are you still there, Peter? Peter, I don't know if we may have lost Peter. We're right in the middle of the conversation. I don't know. Maybe we can bring him back on. My special guest today is Peter Hagelstein from MIT, talking about cold fusion. Hang on, everybody. Let's just see if we can get this sorted out, and we can get him right back on. Hang on just a moment, everybody. Okay. All right. I've notified my producer. We'll see if we can tap back into that. Okay. My special guest today, this is what you should do. If you're listening to the archives or you're listening live, you can just Google Dr. Peter Hagelstein, and you'll see his website at Research Laboratory of Electronics at MIT. And you can see a little bit about him there as well. And there's a link also to a personal website of his that you can see a lot more in respect to his research with cold fusion. Are you there, Peter? Okay, great.
I'm back.
Okay, great. All right. As you were saying.
Well, I had gone to conferences. I'd read papers. I'd visited people's laboratories. And I became convinced that there was something interesting there, but it took 4.5 years at least for that to happen. Subsequently to that, I was involved in some experiments that we did at MIT, and we got some effects that were hard to understand. Basically, by loading, I think it was vanadium, niobium with deuterium, we had one sample produce some gamma rays and show some charge particle emission over the course of, later on, it showed charge particle emission over the course of about 4 or 5 days that we weren't expecting and that we measured and watched.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you, how many times did you fail before you actually had it work before you? Was it 10, 15, 20 times, and then it suddenly worked, the first time?
No, that particular experiment, I think, basically, Louis Smullen had been carrying out the measurements, and he had probably done 25 or 30 experiments previous to this one that was special. And afterwards, there were more than 100 attempts to replicate it. None of which showed any gammas. 4 or 5 of the experiments did show some charged particle emission, but whatever it was that was happening was not particularly reproducible, at least in our hands at that time.
Mm-hmm. So did that cause immediate frustration, not being able to do it again? That's the big mystery, isn't it? Why you cannot light it up, so to speak, at will, isn't it? Is it not?
Well, again, it's a historical kind of thing. Back in the early days, we didn't know so much about the various effects that were happening or what it took to make them show up. So in those days, when we saw the effect, we thought, aha, now we've got something. We'll bring in more diagnostics. We'll do a better job next time. So we had better diagnostics, but the next time never came. At least on that particular experiment. And when it didn't work again and again and again, that was an experience that a lot of people in the field had looking at various anomalies. So they'd get an experiment to do something, it'd show an effect, and then it wouldn't show it again. It was mm-hmm. incredibly frustrating.
Right, right. Now, that's the big mystery, though, why it can't be duplicated. In layman's terms, or in scientific, doesn't matter, why do you think that is, that it cannot be reproduced consecutively?
Well, at that time, it couldn't be reproduced because we didn't know what we did to make it happen in the first place. There were things that were happening in the experiment that were uncontrolled, and we didn't have any idea what they were. So we tried to do the same thing again, but there were subtle things different with the experiment in the subsequent tries, so it didn't happen again. the charged particle signals did happen a few times again, and we thought that was encouraging, that maybe we were getting closer to getting some gammas up. But again, we didn't see it again.
Mm-hmm. So that,
in terms of
what a letdown, huh?
I'm sorry, what?
I was saying, what a letdown. You finally get it going, and then when you want to do it again, then you can't do it. It's like completely frustrating, I imagine.
Well, it was very frustrating, and it was a kind of frustration that an awful lot of people in the field had back in those days. They would see an effect, then the effect would go away, and it sort of didn't matter what experiments got done. The effect stubbornly just wouldn't show up again. And at that point, you'd scratch your head and you'd begin to doubt as to whether what you saw in the first place was right. I mean, the only problem is I know what we saw. when it did something, I know what we saw. We just didn't see it again.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that initially, so if you doubted it, that's an interesting point that means other scientists probably doubted their first witness of it was correct. That's the first time I've heard that's an interesting perspective. Very interesting perspective. Now, here's the thing that, you know, I deal with a lot of the public. Everybody's talking about, you know, this BP oil spill and going to different energy sources and deploying new money into research for such things as cold fusion. In your opinion, are we, let's say, if financing was available for more cold fusion research and public support, how far are we away in terms of years of something practical that cold fusion could help society or the world? It'd be the world issue, you know.
A great question. There's probably a good half hour worth of discussion needed to place an answer into context. Given the way things are going these days, in my view, it's more likely that the research effort will go away prior to any technology reaching the market. There's not so many people left in the field. There's very good people in the field, and people have been working very hard making progress. But there's not solid funding in the field. There's sort of never been solid funding in the field. And people get older, and in some cases they retire or they're not active anymore. And those that are left, Dick Oriani's north of 80. George Miley's getting on in years. I don't know. I don't expect him to be in the field 10 years from now, but you never know.
Right.
Ed Storms is, he's not going to live forever. I mean,
right.
It'd be nice if he did. the issue is there hasn't been new young people generally coming into the field. And, like I say, there's not all that many people in the field that are left. So if you combine restricted funding, if you combine that with all of the damage that happens to people's career when they're in cold fusion, the difficulties with getting publications, getting funding, career advancement, mm-hmm. Like I say, in the crystal ball that I have, the odds on bet are that the current research effort's going to end up being out of business prior to bringing a technology to market.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If there were some significant level of funding addressed to this, then we could do something about training up new people. We could get progress made at a little bit faster clip than currently. And we might actually be able to bring technology to market. But at the moment, I sure don't see how that's going to end up happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay. Well, this program is about what if it could be rather than what it is. And I know what it is. It's kind of in a stalled position. I know it's like a big black ball for young people potentially to get into this field, which is kind of sad to me because it's a totally new area. It should be, in my opinion, I think there should be a lot of young people get into it. But it is kind of career suicide to get involved with it initially if you're a young scientist, is it not? Because of the reputation and money and lack of funding, things of that nature?
It is the case that people in the field have suffered gigantic hits on their career, on their finances, on their lives. It's in that sense, it's been just an absolutely awful field to be associated with. Probably it's a very bad career choice today for new young people to go into, simply because their careers will be destroyed, and you know, it's just not a good thing to have happen. I wish the world were different. I wish there were resources made available. This is a technology that has a chance of making a very big difference to the energy problem and to the
yes.
water problem.
I mean, just that in itself makes it worthy of pouring some money into it, you know, instead of buying an extra tank or spending some millions over here. I don't understand. Well, I do understand, because the issue is, would you not agree with this, that suddenly, if let's say you do get the funding, you get what you want, you get what you need, and people are trained, and you're getting cooperation from the public and everywhere else, okay, then you've got it. Say then you get to where you want to go. That is a threat to everything else that's out there, is it not? Is this part of the reason why we're in a stalled position? Because it's going to be a threat to the electrical company, the gas company. People are not going to want to use those sources of energy anymore if they know something like this is available. And I'm talking about way in the future.
Let's see, I don't know that I can say anything relevant to that. I'm not a believer in conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. The reason there's been no funding is because some very smart physics folks who are not very familiar with what's happened in the field are convinced that there's nothing here, no possibility of there ever being an effect. And because of that, they advise people in the government and investors that putting money in this area is a bad idea. So as a result, there's not much in the way of resources. I mean, I guess I'm more interested in talking about what I know about the effect, what it is that people have measured, and the implications of that for technology that comes along in the future.
That's perfectly
fine. Not very good at talking about conspiracies here.
No. We're not going to go there. I just want to see, like, in a perfect world, with the amount of money and support, how much money is needed? Because there's a guy on the board here that's just from Crescent City, California, just asking Dr. Peter Hagelstein, how much money is needed to push it forward at high speed?
I don't know. A great question. I happen not to know the answer. The basic issue is that you've got something in the neighborhood of between 10 and 20 groups on the planet who are doing work which is moving the science forward in some way. And these groups, I mean, different groups could use different amounts of money that would right now make a huge difference. For example, in my own case, this year I did pretty well. I have a good chance of I have enough money that I brought in this year. I'm going to be able to pay a collaborator something in the general neighborhood of between $5,000 and $6,000 for subsidized travel expenses so I can work with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's probably what I'm going to look at next year, and that's what I saw last year. And, you know, it would be fun to actually have some funding so I could put more of an effort, get more of an effort going in the area.
Right. Absolutely.
A colleague of mine in Texas is looking at scaling back his experimental program, in part because the oil spill is causing a reduction in BP dividends. Those BP dividends have been going into buying heavy water and buying palladium cathodes to make experiments happen.
Uh-huh.
So that's being cut back. So the answer is that an amount of money that would be considered to be trivial in the grand scheme of things, would make an enormous difference right now. But that money just, it's not available, and it hasn't been available, and I don't see any way it becomes available any time in the near future. If something in the neighborhood of $10 million were injected into the field in the coming year, that would look like an infinite amount of money to...
Really? That's not a lot of money. That's not a lot. I thought you were going to say like $100 million. But that $10 million? No. Well, that's a big difference. And I'm quite shocked that you said that, actually. Because we're going to – hey, listen, Peter, we're going to take a quick break. And after that, okay. there's a message on the board here from Ruby relevant to what you just said, actually. And we'll get to that right after this break. Stand by.
So maybe we should all be praying for time.
PowerHits.com.
Hello, everybody. This is James Martinez from The Cashflow Show. The great poet Robert Frost once said, quote, "A bank is a place where they lend you an umbrella in fair weather and ask for it back when it begins to rain," end quote. I'd like to show you how you can take back your power and your financial freedom. You may be already aware of your inherent need to create your own financial future rather than someone else deciding for you. In the days ahead, you'll be faced with more and more financial duress unless you take action and take your power back. If you've been faced with substantial alleged credit card debt or foreclosure, call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655. You may begin to know that it's time. Time to begin to imagine a life where you know your true value isn't working for a bank, rather making your bank work for you. Invoke your desires and make it so. Call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655.
Enlightenment. AchieveRadio.com.
Hi, everybody. This is James Martinez from The Cashflow Show. For years, you've heard me speak about your money, your financial future, and your responsibility to yourself. Today, more than ever, with increasing toxicity in our foods and water, it's time for you to take charge of your life and take back that which is rightfully yours, your health and your wealth. I'd like to introduce you to Ion Ways, the answer to your health and financial future. If you're looking to start your own business or take back your health, Ion Ways is the solution. Please go to www.ionways.com/James Martinez. Whether it's to start your own business or take control of your health, you'll not find a better company and products to do so. For the best in the market of energized, ionized, and alkaline water, go to www.ionways.com/James Martinez. For powerful antioxidant effects, superior hydration, more oxygen, and proper pH, remember, health is the only wealth. That's www.ionways.com/James Martinez.
And oh, just like that river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
Okay, welcome back, everybody. This is James Martinez. We're back with Dr. Peter Hagelstein. I think that's the best news I've heard in a long time, Dr. Hagelstein, is $10 million. I thought you were going to say like $100 million or something like that. I don't even think that's out of the question. But anyway, there's
anyway,
a bit of...
The $10 million make a huge difference in the research program internationally for all the researchers currently working on cold fusion. That's not going to bring a device to market, but that would make a gigantic difference in the rate at which the science gets done.
Hey, I think look, that's the best news I've heard in a long time. But there's a message here on the board from Eureka, Ruby in Eureka, who says if we want to invest in this area, how would we go and start and do that? Who do we contact? Say somebody, you know, I have a lot of people listening. If somebody's going to invest money into that, who do they need to contact to do so?
Well, it's a great question. Unfortunately, there's a headache. And the headache is as follows. In this day and age, in any other area, the way that investing happens is that first government support is made such that basic research gets done. Once basic research has gotten done, so there's some kind of technology that investors can move forward on and have a chance of making a profit on and so forth, then it goes on. But it tends not to happen before the initial research gets done. You tend not to make much of a profit in this day and age when you're investing in the research and you're not investing in building things and selling things. So the headache is that because of that, what the resources that are needed these days are needed in order to get the research done. However, an investor putting in money into early stage research at this point, most likely what's going to happen is that money will be spent on doing the research. The primary conclusion that's going to come is that more research is needed and more support is needed. And an investor very quickly is going to start scratching their head and say, well, you know, I wanted to make a profit on my investment. I didn't want to just support scientific research for the sake of supporting scientific research. But unfortunately, in this particular area, until there's a source of government funding to move the basic research forward, there aren't very many options that are interesting. But
okay. Hang on a second. Hang on. That you're talking about government funding. I'm talking about private funding. Somebody comes to you or to me or someone or Dr. Storm, because I got a lot of people that are interested in seeing this thing manifest and happen the way everybody would like to. That is what I'm referring to. Do they call you? Do they email you?
What I'm suggesting is that there's a headache here, in that in order to move the field forward, in order to have there be a technology that reaches the market, there needs to be some research done, and the amount of research that needs to be done is we don't know how much research is going to be needed. I don't know if it's $10 million or $100 million worth of research that's needed before you get something you can bring to market. And as a result, if I'm going to provide some advice to an investor one way or another, it's really hard for me to encourage an investor to put money into an area where an unknown amount of research needs to be done prior to a technology coming to market.
Let me rephrase it this way, Peter, because there's my board is lighting up and I'm getting emails as well. Let's call it a donation instead of an investment. Somebody's, you know, they're 85 years old. They're not going to live forever. They have money to spare. They want to donate something good for the future, for the next generation. That's a completely different matter, is it not?
That can work, and that can work well. I'm actually able to take gift money at MIT to help support research here with no difficulty.
Okay. All right. So, Ruby and Eureka asked this to you. Suppose there's a foundation who would support basic research and not necessarily need a return on a device. Who would they contact? So if they wanted to contact you with private donation money, to say, you know, they're not going to be asking for, you know, funds back and dividends back on their initial investment, because this is initial R&D from somebody that has excess cash to spare. Because I know I'm going to get emails about this, and I know people are listening in multiple countries that I've talked to in government.
Once again, I'm able to take money here for use for my research and the research of the people that I work with. There are other people in other groups that also need money. And it's actually much more efficient to get money to them directly. And again, I can provide pointers, addresses, and phone numbers and emails and addresses and things like that in order to get the money to where it would do the most good.
Then that is exactly what – great. I'm glad you brought that up because – There's a lot of people behind the scenes that they've emailed me regarding they want to see this happen in their lifetime. They want to see people to reproduce it, and you know, perhaps if it's not in this lifetime, it's in their children's lifetime.
Let's be clear that the effect that's interesting here is the one that produces energy, and mm-hmm. it's thought to be of nuclear origin. The byproduct is helium-4. It's thought deuterium goes in, helium-4 comes out, and you get a great deal of energy. The amount of radiation that gets produced in the process is very tiny. It seems to be less than one neutron per joule of energy produced, which is incredibly clean by these scales. So it looks to me like the effect exists. It looks like we know pretty much these days what it takes to get the effect to occur. We know a lot about what the process is. We know a lot about what it takes to reproduce the effect. And the notion that there could be a technology coming out of this, it's a reasonable thing to talk about. We're not sure that there's going to be a technology that comes out of it, but it's not something that looks like it's an impossible outcome at this point. And mm-hmm. between myself and the other people that work in this area, we would very much love to see a useful technology coming out of it, and we're resource limited. We've been resource limited for decades here.
Right. I totally understand that. Now, let's go to actually some of the actual research that's come out. I'm sure you're aware of the 60 Minutes piece. What was your take on when they went to go visit the labs in Israel? And there apparently the story, the reason it came out, so I'm told, is because of their results at that lab were a little bit better than a lot of other people's. What's your take on that?
My understanding was that the reason they went forward with the program is because when 60 Minutes was first considering doing a program on it, that they got so much... people were, some very powerful physics folks were so unhappy with it that their unhappiness translated into CBS starting to take an interest in doing the program. With respect to the science in the laboratory, the Israeli team, the energetics team, Shaul Lessen and Arik El-Bohar and company, they're very good. They've had some serious resources. They've been working with the SRI team, the Ennio Frascati team, and NRL, and they've gotten some very, very interesting results. They've seen very large energy gain, something in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 energy gain, in something in the neighborhood of 5 experiments out of several hundred. So the reproducibility of this very large excess energy effect, the reproducibility is poor. On the other hand, many of their other experiments produce several fold worth of energy gain, like factors of 1 or 2 or 3 increase in the energy of the thermal output over the input energy. So the science is good. The focus on these very high energy gain experiments, I guess that's what you need for the public to be interested. But I guess I'm much more interested in how they go about getting significant energy gains, the techniques they use, the science behind how they can do as well as they do with their high reproducibility of modest energy gains. And mm-hmm. that's, in my way of thinking, that's actually closer to what you need for a technology, an early cold fusion technology to reach the market. Mm-hmm. There are other groups that work on cold fusion that have interesting results. There are other groups that have seen large energy gains a few times, and there are other groups that can reach factors of 3 or higher energy gain on a reasonably regular basis, or at least they claim that they can. And I think that's very important, very interesting, and worthy of public attention as well.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that when people are reproducing these experiments in different labs at other times, are all of you on the same side? In other words, are you guys really competitive and may not share your results right away, or may not share your results at all? Is there other groups of scientists that may not be full disclosure, so to speak, in terms of what's happening currently or what they've reproduced and how they've reproduced it?
I guess that depends on the group and how they're supported. For example, the Israeli effort received a fair amount of private support, and as a result, there probably wasn't a large amount of motivation to come forward with technical details from research that has been supported with private money. I'm very pleased that they've been as forthcoming about their results as they have.
Do you think because of the BP oil spill, I mean, it's a tragedy in itself that's dealing with for a lot of people. They're having their whole lives are being changed. People are seriously taking a look at why we still using oil in these other research, energy resources, which we don't need anymore. I mean, do you see in your lifetime, if it's not cold fusion, will there be some sort of advanced free energy technology that will ever be employed in a society in your lifetime, do you feel?
I'm afraid that you're talking to somebody who's pretty much a skeptic. I'm a believer that we're perfectly capable of relying on oil as long as possible. If you look over funding in the U.S. and alternative energies over a longer time scale, you'll find a terrible track record. And there are reasons for it. In science, to get new technologies to come forward and to get new basic results, it takes a sustained research effort over a fair amount of time to be really effective. Unfortunately, it's not the case that you can put in an awful lot of money over a short time and solve hard scientific or technological problems. I mean, part of the problems that we've got is that we've got more people than we've got resources for, and there's not a simple technological solution to that that anyone wants to contemplate. We rely on oil and fossil fuel, and there's very good reasons. It's been economical. It's been a good way to do things. Unfortunately, it's got the side effect that it does bad things to the environment in many different areas. However, currently the economics, I mean, people make a lot of money because of this, and they're willing to put up with the damage to the environment and the fact that it's not a renewable resource. So I think people are perfectly capable of continuing to act in a way that's locally beneficial to them and not globally beneficial to all of us. I think that's just the way things are going to keep on going. I think we're going to have oil shortages. The prices are going to go way up. They're going to kill the economies of the different countries of the world much worse than today. And I think we're just going to be in a very bad situation. A lot of people can see it coming, same as me, and we haven't been doing the kinds of things we need to change the trajectory. So I'm not much of a believer in new technologies coming to the rescue on a time scale that's a relevant time scale. A cold fusion is one that probably could, but collectively the world's chosen not to go that route.
They've chosen at the moment, but I can tell you, just based upon what I've and this small broadcast of what I've done, There's a lot of people, the public wants to know more about this. They want to see more money poured into it, and they want to see, you know, an adventure. It took an adventure to get to the moon, and this is an even bigger adventure, I feel.
This is one area that the public should want to know everything it can possibly know about, because this is something that can make a difference to some very tough problems that are out there.
No, I completely agree. Absolutely. Do your students, because I know you've been a teacher, have your students privately talk to you, or have you discouraged them from even looking down this rabbit hole with cold fusion, or it's just not a thing people, it's a taboo subject for a young, enthusiastic scientist to address?
It would probably be viewed as being irresponsible for me to encourage my students to go into cold fusion. It is a reasonable thing for a student to spend some time working on it, the idea being that after graduating, the student has the potential for getting work doing other things if there's no cold fusion industry developed. But I think people would frown on a professor that tries to encourage students to go into a field where their careers are going to get damaged. It's not something that you want to.
Right.
I mean, generally, I like my students.
Right.
I like working with them, and I care about what happens to them.
Right. So if a guy comes up to you and says, you know, Dr. Hagelstein, you know, I've been thinking, you know, I would like to, you know, go into this area. And if they really want to do that, and that's where they set their sights on, you would discourage that then?
What I would do is I would try to make sure that they were fully aware as to the gigantic price that you pay for trying to work in this area and do some good for the planet.
Yeah,
it's one thing to try to do some good. However, if you try to do good in this day and age, it comes with a price, and that price is very high.
Yes, it is. No, I completely agree with that. However, I am looking for inspired young people that are listening to this. I know I've got a lot of listeners all over the place. If you're out there, you're hearing it from a guy that's directly involved, and I hope that some of you have a sense of adventure, because it needs as much public support and education as possible. Now, when you've, what other universities have you spoken to in terms of, you know, your presentations based upon what you've done, and how has it been received when you have spoken about it publicly?
I think the last time that I was asked to speak publicly at a university on cold fusion, I think was Princeton in the 1990s. And past that, there's no invitations coming from any university to talk about cold fusion. Actually, I think I'm in error. University of Missouri Columbia held a workshop, and they invited me last year, a year and a half ago, something like that. So that's the one exception.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, have you ever given speeches or discussed the matter and people other than scientists, just the regular public, the regular Joe in the public that wants to hear about cold fusion? And if you have, how have they reacted?
Generally, when I speak to people who are not scientists, the thing I'm best at doing is putting them to sleep. But the answer is no. I've not given talks on this to the general public.
Mm-hmm. If you were asked to, would you?
It's not been something I've had to worry about so far.
No, but I'm saying I'm perhaps later on that there may be a time where, you know, there may be people other than scientists that want to hear about cold fusion. The reason why I'm saying is there's going to be an active effort to uplift this and kind of make you guys stars, because as far as I'm concerned, it's guys like you that really have the potential and understanding to do something great.
In as much as there's an active effort to put this back on the radar screen, there'll be a very much larger effort to stomp it out. So I don't actually think I'm going to have to worry very much about it.
Okay, so your challenge, you're going to try and prove me wrong, right?
Well, I wish you luck in your efforts, but like I said, I'm not very optimistic about things. I think working in science as long as I've worked in it has made me very much a skeptic.
Mm-hmm.
Cold fusion's okay, but everything else about how business gets done and the people working on the energy problem or other scientists, I'm probably one of the more reactionary skeptics you'll run across.
Okay, is business and discovery don't mix, do they, in your world?
I imagine that there was a time, maybe a lot of years ago, where business people and investors understood that you needed to invest in research to move technology forward, to keep your business competitive and to make new things happen. That I imagine that there was a time where investors actually did invest in research in the hopes that the research would lead to new technologies that they'd make a large profit on. That model could be very effective in the cold fusion business these days. It's not a model that, as far as I know, anybody subscribes to in this day and age.
So it really comes down to somebody with a sense of adventure that is willing to part with their own individual money to give it to someone privately and do so without expecting any dividends or returns back. That's
one possibility. There's another possibility that says you go ahead and you put together a company, but the company's going to be a long-term kind of company that recognizes it has research that it needs to do. If somebody started a company and capitalized it with something in the neighborhood of $50 million of money to devote to research to build a prototype in this area, there's a decent chance that whoever did that, if they got the right researchers together, would end up cashing in with big bucks later on.
Yeah, well, listen, I would just want to let you know that you have my full support publicly. I know my listeners are supportive, guys like you that are going for it. And we will try and continue on regardless of the opinions and attitude of the relationship between money and discovery, because it seems to me that this is something important enough, especially with all the amount of people and effort that's been put forth with little or next to no money. Yet people are still involved. There's no money in it, yet people are still involved and associated with it. So I hope you continue on with this. Is that what are your career plans in terms of cold fusion? Are you just going to be a thing on the side while you do these other things, or?
My primary research efforts for an awful long time have been in the area of cold fusion. I work on it because it's an important problem to make a difference in this planet. It's the one area of research that I know of that I can work on, that I have a chance of making a real difference in the energy problem.
Amen to that. Amen to that. That's good. That's music to my ears. See, if you're willing to make the effort, I think other people that are in positions should support you guys that are doing this. And that's what I was talking to Storm about.
I don't know about that. Most other people are smarter than me in that regard.
Yeah, but you're the guy on, right? Hey, I mean, what was it like, really, in this short synopsis of when you lit it up and you saw cold fusion work right in front of your very eyes? Did that change your universe?
No, not at all. And mostly because I had been tracking experiments that had been done in other laboratories and research, you know, results that other people had gotten. So I had been impressed, by the sum total of a very large number of experimental results. The result that we got was not a particularly important result in the grand scheme of things.
But it was a result.
Sure.
Yeah. There you go. Hey, I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time for doing this. I'm sure at some point in the future, we'd love to have you back again as we see this thing unroll. But I very much appreciate you taking the time, and, you know, our listeners back you up 100%. And we will do our best effort to support you.
Very good. It's been fun being on your show.
Thank you so much, Peter Hagelstein. Dr. Peter Hagelstein from MIT, everybody. Please go to his website, Google his name. You can read all about him. Thanks a lot, everybody. This is James Martinez with Cash Show. Remember, next week we're having actor and comedian Rick Overton on Wednesday Ion, and the 22nd we'll be having David Cobb one more time. All right, everybody. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for emails. Thanks for your support. Bye-bye.
Can you hear it rain? It makes you want to sing. It's such a beautiful thing. Yeah. Money and things. Ka-ching.
AchieveRadio.com.
Hello, everybody. This is James Martinez from The Cash Flow Show. The great poet Robert Frost once said, quote, "A bank is a place where they lend you an umbrella in fair weather and ask for it back when it begins to rain," end quote. I'd like to show you how you can take back your power and your financial freedom. You may be already aware of your inherent need to create your own financial future rather than someone else deciding for you. In the days ahead, you'll be faced with more and more financial duress unless you take action and take your power back. If you've been faced with substantial alleged credit card debt or foreclosure, call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655. You may begin to know that it's time. Time to begin to imagine a life where you know your true value isn't working for a bank, rather making your bank work for you. Invoke your desires and make it so. Call 888-213-7655. That's 888-213-7655.
Hits.com.